So first of all, thank you very much for having me over. It's always a pleasure to be here. I was here about 5 years ago when this building was half as big, and I see it developed very well. So yeah, I'm going to talk about work based, well, the talk is going to be based mostly on these two papers, a paper I wrote in January that has been published on JCAP, and a paper I submitted together with a student at UMass, Jessica Cook, about 1 month and a half ago. And I'm going to talk about non-standard tensor modes from inflation. So first, let me try to qualify what non-standard means. Every time you have a known something in a title, that's pretty vague, you know. So what I will mean mostly in this talk will be two things that I actually will correspond to two parts of the talk. First part of the talk, I will talk about non-standard tensor modes, and non-standard will mean parity violating. In the second part of the talk, non-standard will be detectable by ground-based interferometers, okay? Actually, there will be a couple of slides in which I will hint at other possible non-standard properties of this stuff, like large three-point functions and blue power spectrum. But mostly, I will be talking about these two things, okay? So let me start first part talking about parity violation. So motivation. Motivation is the following, okay? Cosmic microwave background contains information about three fundamental quantities, the T spectrum, the E spectrum, and the B spectrum, okay? And what I really will care about here is the fact that the, unlike the T and E spectrum that are parity even, the B spectrum is parity odd, okay? So if I study correlation functions of TB and EB in the sky, since it's the multiplication of a parity even times a parity odd quantity, if the CMB is parity respecting, this stuff should be equal to zero, okay? So one can go the other way around and ask the question, what if, you know, we are going to see an improvement in CMB data? What if Planck or any other CMB experiment that cares about B modes observes a non-zero correlation TB and AB, okay? And of course, this could come from two possible sources. This could correspond to something that happened before CMB decoupled from the primordial fluid or afterwards. What I will assume is that we can prove, and as I will hint at later on, at we have some hope that we can prove whether this parity violation can be due to some late universe as opposed to some early universe dynamics. And I will assume that for some reason we find out that it's due to some early universe dynamics. And then we will have to face the question, what mechanism can generate this parity violation in the early universe, okay? What I will try to argue is that there is a quite natural setting in which you expect this to happen. And natural is actually, and the word is not chosen randomly, as I will say, show in a second. So an obvious source of parity, primordial parity violation is a pseudoscalar inflaton, okay? If the inflaton is a pseudoscalar, it's rolling down its potential. In principle, it will generate some P or some T violation, okay? Now, why should we care about a pseudoscalar inflaton? First reason why we should care about it is that, you know, the inflaton is either a scalar or a pseudoscalar. So in 50% of cases, I would expect it to be a pseudoscalar, but that's sort of a cheap answer. So let me try to give a slightly more expensive answer. It is the following. We all know, I guess, that if we want to have a model of inflation, usually what we want to have is a potential that is flat in units of the Planck scale, okay? And of course, I can always write down a potential, and if I work not that hard, I can write down any potential that satisfies this condition. But writing down a potential is not enough to guarantee that this potential, these conditions are satisfied also at the quantum level. In other words, once I write down a potential and I write down, you know, general couplings of the inflaton to matter, I expect quantum loops to spoil the flatness of the potential, okay? So that the system cannot, well, so that we cannot really predict anymore its flatness based on its classical flatness. So how can we keep these radiative effects under control? Well, before we start worrying about this thing, let me state that the situation is actually not as terrible as sometimes we think. There is a very simple solution to this thing. Suppose that the inflaton interacts only with gravity and nothing else. Then if the inflaton interacts only with gravity and nothing else, then all we can generate at the level of quantum corrections are either Coleman-Weinberg corrections to the inflaton potential or gravitational loops potential correction to the gravitational to the potential. In particular, if the potential is V of phi, it's possible to prove that the first contribution from gravitational loops come in this form and this form. And both these terms are actually not dangerous as long as V is smaller than the Planck scale. Both here and here, we don't get large corrections to the, you know, this whatever slower parameters. But in general, that's the point. In general, there will be coupling to other fields, and the loops corrections to other fields can generate dangerous operators, okay? So one typical way one can protect himself, that people can protect themselves from this couplings to other fields, is to assume that there is some symmetry, okay?
Yes. Go back a bit, because the statement that gravity is unimportant.
Yes. At the perturbative level.
Well, it's not a renormalizable theory, so you don't really know.
We don't really know if we believe in in decoupling.
Should we?
Should we not?
Are you also not just dropping quadratic divergences here?
Sorry.
When you quoted those results, you mean if you neglect quadratic divergences?
Yeah. You mean quadratically divergent?
Quadratic divergences. Oh. But there are, if you replace the cutoff by the Planck scale, then there'll be Planck mass.
But then we have worse problems than doing inflation with this stuff. I agree with you, but then we have also quartic divergences, but that's even a worse problem than doing inflation. Actually, no, we can do inflation very well with the quartic divergences if you want.
I mean, there's a very basic problem. We can't compute the vacuum energy.
That's a very basic problem.
But the vacuum energy drives inflation, so we can't calculate. So
is it really vacuum energy?
Absolutely. Inflation is the temporary.
It's a temporary.
Temporary phase of life.
Well, that's so the my concern is about the word temporary. In that sense, I'm not sure I would. I would call it something that mimics a cosmological constant for a certain amount of time.
Right.
I'm assuming that somebody came in this room and solved the cosmological constant problem for me. Gauge hierarchy problem. Somebody just came in this room.
That would be nice.
My goal here will be more modest. Okay. However, one thing, I think, you know, if we learn something about the standard model and radiative stability of the standard model of particle physics, and that is something that seems to work quite well, is that usually symmetries work well at protecting small operators, okay? So the idea would be, and what is a recurrent idea in this kind of setup?
But you see, yes. My objection is that all this effective theory philosophy is all well and good, and it works in particle physics, but it fails abysmally in predicting the vacuum energy.
I'm perfectly fine with
so
it.
So why do we trust it?
Neil, I have to disagree with that.
Okay.
So I would say that there are examples where it doesn't fail.
What?
So I have a whole talk I can give you on that. So it's the assertion that there is no way to do it in effective field theory, I think, is the thing that's not so clear. I think it's true generically. Unfortunately, I came in when the middle of this discussion, so I don't really know what you're being criticized for. but
it's not being criticized. That's
no
point.
Okay.
No, that's yeah.
So you think you have some models in which effective theory works and lambdas calculable.
And even if you, I think the attitude to take if you're a conservative and you said that you know, you don't believe my model, the statement about the cosmological constant problem is not really to do with divergences, but it's just to do with threshold as you come through various, as you integrate out particles, is it always zero or is it always small? And you can just take the point of view that you don't care, right? That there's a we're learning the value of the cosmological constant, and it's whatever value it is from experiment. And the fact that there's cancellation as you integrate out particles is just the way nature works, and it's the first time it's happened, but that might be the way nature works. But it wouldn't be an invalidation of the effective field theory principles, in the sense that you'd still have control of the low energy approximation. Nothing there would change.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't smell right to me. It sounds like, depends on what he's going to do, right?
First of all, I'm only partially going to use this stuff, and I would like to, but still, I think this is still, it's not the main point of my talk, okay? But I think it's as a matter of principle, it's an important point. Mm-hmm. And of course, cosmological constant problem, no matter how you put it, is a big problem. And I think we could start discussing about, you know, let's postpone it. Let me assume that somebody comes in this room, or somebody has just come into this room and found a field theoretical symmetry that sets the cosmological constant to zero, and then I can make it small in a radiatively stable way. Okay. Mm-hmm. Same with quadratic divergences. And again, you know, instead of caring about the quadratic divergences in the inflaton mass, I would care about the quadratic divergences in the Higgs mass. That would be, you know, 10 to 30 bigger problem than the quadratic divergences in inflaton mass. What I wanted to discuss is, however, the possibility that in the inflaton sector, there's something that is going on from the particle physics point of view, similar to what's going on in the standard model. In the standard model, we have controllably small quantities, and they happen, all the quantities that we observe to be small in the standard model are small, and they're associated to some broken symmetry. Okay, so can we do something similar to the inflaton? Can we first find a symmetry that then we will want to break that guarantees the flatness of the inflaton potential? And well, what the best people think people came out with is a shift symmetry. Okay, in particular, as long as the shift symmetry is exact, I cannot write a potential for V of phi. So it's an invariance of inflaton goes to inflaton plus a constant. If the symmetry is exact, this is only a constant. And as I was saying before, that's actually a perfect solution. We can have a fantastic model of inflation. The problem is that inflation lasts forever. And since this is not what we observe, or this is not what we want, at least, from inflationary model building, we deduce that an exact shift symmetry is an overkill. Still, it's a good way of starting to kill the problem. So we can start killing the problem with the shift symmetry, and then we can break the symmetry a little bit and see if we can get inflation then. It turns out that actually this is possible, and there is a simple example that I will present, and I don't want to care about the details again, but it's a qualitative description. If phi, the inflaton, is a phase of a complex field, then the global shift symmetry is actually a global U1. Okay, so we can write a Lagrangian for a global U1, and I can write my favorite Lagrangian for a global U1, where H is some complex field, where phi is the phase of H, and I have a Mexican head potential there, and I decompose the way we all know. And turns out that phi at this level is a massless Goldstone boson, so what I will care about is a pseudoscalar, and at this level it's massless. Again, it doesn't have a potential. V of phi is a constant. Then I can invoke some breaking by some strong dynamics of this global U1, where some lambda that I don't want to know where it comes from. But let's say it comes from something that goes to zero as I decouple some sector. And then I just put this ansatz here. I forget about the delta H because it's heavy. And what I get is a cosine potential. Okay, and this is a pseudo Nambu-Goldstone boson. This guy was a Nambu-Goldstone boson. Now, this is not an exact symmetry anymore. This is why it's a pseudo one. And I get a potential of this form. And this was actually the first potential for inflation, as far as I know, that was motivated by naturalness arguments. And it was the so-called model of natural inflation that was proposed by Katie Fries and collaborators more than 20 years ago now. Since then, well, then people found that there were some technical problems with this, and people worked out the details and worked out possible new models. This is not the only example, therefore. And here there is a bunch of other systems that work more or less well and can be embedded more or less well in some more or less UV complete theory, for which you get always that the inflaton is some pseudoscalar that is rolling down its potential. Okay? This is true for all these models, and I'm pretty sure I'm forgetting somebody. And you know, chances are that I'm forgetting somebody that is in this room and wrote a model of inflation driven by a pseudoscalar. So I apologize from the beginning on that. But I hope I will make my point strong by saying that there's many models where the inflaton is a pseudoscalar and there is some strong motivation for it. Okay? So let me go back to what was my original point. That is, there are many well-motivated models where the inflaton is a PNGB that is a pseudoscalar, so that there is macroscopic parity violation. The question I want to ask is, how can this parity violation be transferred to the CMB? Okay? So if the inflaton is a pseudoscalar, again, in a sort of effective field theory approach, it will have to couple to some to U1 gauge fields through this pseudoscalar coupling. Okay? This parameter F is a dimension, mass dimension one parameter that measures the coupling of this, the strength of this coupling. By the way, usually people write models of natural inflation is cosine of phi over F. Forget about that F. This F is now a coupling, and I'm assuming a general V of phi potential. Okay? So F controls only this coupling. So now I have this electromagnetic field, let's say a U1 or, you know, U1 subgroup of a bigger group, I don't really care now, that is coupled to this time-dependent background. Phi is rolling down its potential. As long as phi is a constant, this is irrelevant because it's a total derivative. But if phi becomes time-dependent, this becomes physically irrelevant. So I can decompose this guy on this background. And what I have a nice quadratic Lagrangian for the electromagnetic field on a time-dependent background. And this we know how to deal with. So I decompose it, and in particular, it's convenient to decompose the gauge field into elicity modes, okay? And then the mode functions satisfy this equation. So this is derivative with respect to conformal time, momentum. What is important is this coupling to the inflaton. As you see, this depends on the time. Well, this is conformal time derivative of the inflaton. So as long as phi prime is equal to zero, doesn't contribute, as I was saying before. What really matters is that there is this lambda here. So depending on elicity, this coupling can be either positive or negative. If you assume that phi prime over f is positive, for lambda negative, I can have for a certain range of values of the scale factor that this term is overall negative, bless you. And as a consequence, I can have an exponential amplification of only one of the two modes. Okay. What is nice is that as time goes on, when the modes redshift very much outside of the horizon, even if this thing stays negative, it gets small very quickly. So that actually I have an exponential amplification that is relevant only for about a nifold, okay? But each mode is exponentially amplified. And this is true only for the negative lambda, okay? Well, this stuff is not order one nifold because as modes redshift out, the whole thing becomes zero because this is proportional to momentum. So as momentum redshifts out, the whole thing goes to zero. So it stays negative, but it becomes very quickly zero. Yes, but there is a 1 over a here, if you prefer. There is a prime here. If I assume that phi dot is constant, then there is a scale factor there. I always have doubts whether to present this in comoving or in physical coordinates, because in physical, then you have all the h, a dot, et cetera, and it's clearer there, but it's less clear in the. Okay. And this was something that we worked out actually with Mohammed 5 years ago. Wow. The important thing is this is true only for lambda negative. For lambda positive, this is always positive. Nothing happens, OK? The modes stay in their vacuum or almost in their vacuum. They get some very small excitation. You can solve this equation exactly, phi dot is constant. And then when you solve it exactly, you find out that the left-handed mode of the photon gets exponentially amplified in this quantity, phi dot over fh. Now, phi dot goes as square root of epsilon m Planck times h. So this stuff goes as square root of epsilon m Planck over f. So this is m Planck over 10f, more or less. If f is smaller than a tenth of a Planck mass, this stuff gets huge. Now, one thing I forgot to say. So as a consequence of this, the inflaton is rolling down, and we have a parity-violating coupling. And now I see that the parity violation has been transferred to the photons, because now only left-handed photons are around, no right-handed photons. So that's a consequence of the parity violation. So next question I want to ask is, these photons are going to source gravitational waves, so they're going to transfer part of their parity violation to the gravitational waves. So it's a two-step process. So I decompose my metric into, well, I look at the tensor modes, and again, since I will care about parity violation, I decompose it into left-handed and right-handed gravitons. I can write the equations of motion for the left-handed and the right-handed gravitons, okay? Usually when we do it during inflation, this is zero. But now there is a population of photons that is filling my universe all the time. And it's the stationary population. As they get produced, they get diluted, and they are stationarily there. So when I solve this, I have to take into account, well, this equation, this is the projector on helicity lambda, this is the stress energy tensor of the photons. Let me call this whole thing T lambda, okay? I know the right-hand side, and so I can solve this equation using retarded propagator. I go fast here because this is just simple technicalities. So this is my retarded propagator, and from that I deduce what's the amplitude, the two-point function of the inflaton will depend on the two-point function of this T lambda. Since the left-handed and the right-handed photons have different amplitude, also the left-handed and right-handed components of their stress energy tensor will have different amplitude. Okay? And as a consequence, the left-handed and the right-handed components of the graviton will have different amplitude. And yes?
So how does the energy in photons increase
with
time? Or
it's stationary. Yeah. It's a fixed fraction of the background energy. I'm doing an approximation that Hubble parameter is constant and phi dot is a constant. Then there are small corrections. So, okay, this is the result of math. Where's the physics? The physics is simple. If I have two helical photons that hit each other head on and they produce a graviton, the graviton can be both left-handed and right-handed. But if the two photons fuse with small transverse momentum, then by conservation of angular momentum, also the photon, the graviton will inherit this this helicity. Because of this, I will produce both right-handed and left-handed gravitons, even if I start with only left-handed photons, because I have the head-on collisions, but the amplitude will be different. Of course, on the top of this, one has to solve for the homogeneous part of the equation. Remember, we had a non-homogeneous differential equation. We have to solve add the homogeneous part of the equation. Of course, this just corresponds to the standard vacuum fluctuations of the graviton. So I put everything together, and this is the power spectrum I obtain. I have a left-handed and a right-handed graviton power spectrum. And I have two components. This is the standard component. This is what I would get in the absence of the photons. And what I get here is that I have a different amplitude. These numbers, I get asked this question every time I give this talk. These numbers are just numbers, okay? They are two pi's and gammas of something. They just come out of integrals. This is why sometimes you have to be careful about putting order one numbers there. And what is important is that the amplitude, so the difference in this corresponds to parity violation. The amplitude is exponential in this xi. Remember, xi is phi dot over fh, basically. Why is this exponential in this xi? Because the amount of photons is also exponential in xi. Okay? So of course, one thing we have to be careful is to make sure that the back reaction of the photons on the background is not important, and I will come to that point in a second. But what I get at this point is that there is parity violation transferred to the gravitational waves. Okay? So now I have this stuff. Now the question is, can we see it? Because of course, the fact that it's there is not enough to be able to see. And there is a bunch of studies on this, and in particular, I will refer to this last paper. The possibility of detecting these things depend on two parameters. One that is the tensor to scalar ratio, and one that is the amount of parity violation that I call delta chi, okay? Left-handed minus right-handed over the sum. And Okay, nobody can see anything, I guess. But this is a plot stolen by this Gluszewicz-Kamienkowski paper. And the way we read it is the following. On the x-axis, we have r. On the y-axis, we have delta chi. Okay? So this line, for instance, corresponds to Planck. Suppose that we are here. That is, we have r equal to 0.22 and delta chi equal to 1. So we have fully chiral gravitational waves with r equal to 0.22. Then we are in this corner here. This means that Planck will be able to detect parity violation at about 2 sigma, because this is 1 sigma, and this is 0.51. So it's 2 sigma. CMB Paul will be able to detect this at 5 sigmas. Okay. Of course, as you reduce r, or if you do reduce delta chi, things get worse. But there is a certain portion of parameter space where stuff is observable. Okay. I can compute what's delta chi for our system. And again, you shouldn't care about 10 to minus 7. What you care about, what you should care about is that there is e to the 4 pi psi. And remember, psi is very easily of the order of 10 or 20. So you have e to the 100 very easily here. Okay, so this can get a very large number. Since it can get a very large number, I would say that delta chi is very easily equal to 1, effectively. And so in principle, I should have underlined, in principle, parity violation would be detectable for a significant portion of the parameter space. Okay. However, while I was writing this paper, my friends, Neil Barnaby and Marco Peloso, decided to come up with something that was very much related to the system. What they did was to compute the non-Gaussianities produced in the same system. In other words, what they studied was the fact that this photons also back react on the inflaton, the same way as they back react on the graviton. And the back reaction on the inflaton is not that strong necessarily, but the correction that they give to the inflaton fluctuations is highly non-Gaussian, because it's produced by something that is quadratic, by a source that is quadratic in a Gaussian field, because the source is f mu nu f mu tilde that is quadratic in the gauge field, and so is non-Gaussian. As a consequence, they have a very strong constraint on psi. If you impose this strong constraint on psi, it turns out that the simplest version, the vanilla version I described up to now, unfortunately, becomes undetectable. Okay. Still, my initial question was, suppose we see TB different from zero, can we explain it? Okay. And what I will try to argue is that there is, well, what I will argue in the next transparency is that there are simple ways out of this system. And then I will discuss other potential systems that could give the same effect, okay? And that have more difficult ways out. So there are ways out for this. One possibility is to assume that there is a curvaton. In other words, most of the curvature perturbations are not given by the inflaton, but by some other field that has Gaussian fluctuations, okay? And so when the perturbation, when the gauge field back reacts on the inflaton, it doesn't back react on the curvaton, so the Gaussianities in the curvaton sector stay where they are. And yes, I have a non-Gaussian perturbation in the inflaton, but this is subdominant. And it turns out that you can tune parameters, in particular if you have about 90% of the perturbations from a curvaton, then you can kill the non-Gaussian components while still having this effect. Another possibility, and then this really depends on your taste, is to assume that there are many gauge fields, okay? I assume that there was just a single one, f mu nu tilde. That, of course, is not realistic. What is realistic is to have some larger group and look at least at the U1 subgroups there. If you suppose that you have 10 to 3 of these guys, and that then really depends on your taste, then what you have is that the effects from each of the gauge fields adds incoherently, and this gives a 1 over square root of n effect on the non-Gaussianities. And so you can kill non-Gaussianities while keeping still scalar perturbations and tensor perturbation psi. This is not so attractive. This is actually not that unnatural. But since this is what we're given, let's see what we get. So for instance, suppose that we have 90% of primordial perturbations given by a curvaton, in which case the constraints from Peloso and Barnaby don't hold anymore at all. So all of this parameter space become available. So this is Hubble parameter in unit of Planck mass. And this is this parameter psi. And as you see, psi is of order 1, OK? And so I have two regions. Below the blue line here, sorry, above the blue line, the amplitude of the tensor modes would be too large. This is a line that corresponds to R equal to 0.24. You know, then you choose the numbers you prefer, but that's the ballpark. And below this line, on the other hand, parity violation would be too small to be detected. That delta chi would be too small, okay? So turns out that there is actually a portion of parameter space where we would have parity violation that would be detectable while still respecting the all the constraints for non-Gaussianities. This looks like a slim region, but notice that this is a log scale. So this region is actually not that slim, okay? Yeah, 0.1. So that's a question related to this thing. The minimum, so this is one, the minimum in a cosmic variance limited experiment they claim is 0.0023. So if R is larger than 2 times 10 to minus 3 and it's fully chiral, then at least in a, you know, in a cosmic variance limited experiment, you will be able to detect it at 1 point something sigmas. Okay. So still, there are a couple of notes. As I said, first of all, this could be also produced by some late universe effect, and this paper by Grushevich and Kamienkowski I mentioned before also shows that it's possible to disentangle the two. If you have the full spectrum of TB and DB, it would look different depending whether it is something that is due to late universe as opposed to some primordial origin of the parity violation. So that's okay. This is a question that I always often get, and so I want to address this also. One would also think that there is another natural coupling that would lead to parity violation, that is coupling to RR tilde. Okay. However, there's a couple of papers by Light and collaborators, and one more recent by Sato, and I think another one. By somebody whose name I'm forgetting now, that study in more detail what is the action for the tensor modes in the theory with phi RR tilde. And what they find is that, as before, we can decompose into elicity modes and we get this nice action for the elicity modes of the graviton, but then there is this amplitude A lambda, and this amplitude depends on this stuff, and as you see, this term is exactly the term that was multiplying phi RR tilde. And the difference with respect to the previous case is that in this case, when this stuff becomes negative, it's not that the mode becomes tachyonic anymore, but it becomes a ghost altogether. In other words, the wrong sign now doesn't multiply just the spatial derivatives, but it multiplies the entire Lagrangian. And the reason is that this guy is a four derivative operator. The ones we considered before was a two derivative operator. So since it is a four derivative operator, one integration by parts gives you a derivative here, but they still have three derivatives. And then they go. One derivative, two derivatives, three derivatives. And as a consequence, if I don't want to get in the regime in which this stuff becomes a ghost, this extra term must be significantly, well, somehow smaller than one. But if this term is smaller than one, it turns out that you cannot have enough parity violation. So this system, on the other hand, is in trouble, at least at this level, okay? Most importantly, and this will bring me to the second part of the talk, if I look again at this curve, and I assume that there is this curvaton that is doing nice things for me, I observe that there is a standard relationship between the amplitude of gravitational waves and the Hubble parameter during inflation doesn't apply anymore, okay? If I go along this line, I told you this line was R equal to 0.24. So usually there is a one-to-one relationship between H and R, but in this case, you see, this line can go down, 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 and I could have observable gravitational waves even if the Hubble parameter were 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 8, 1 GeV, okay? So this is the other interesting property of the system, and this brings me to the second part of the talk, that is try to push this stuff to the extreme, that is not even caring about having large R with low scale inflation, but trying to get even observable gravitational waves that could be observed by LIGO, let's say in 2016. I will talk about it in a second. Yes?
Before you start the second chart, can you go back?
Yes.
So the logic was that you have some parity violating sector, you integrate it out, and you've got some effective theory where you have a phi FF dual.
Yes.
And then you're looking at its consequences. And then you looked at the phi RR dual thing, and it gave you something sick.
Yes.
But if I have a parity violating sector and I integrate it out, I'll get both of those things typically, right?
Yes, but.
So why doesn't that mean that the sick thing wins? That the
okay, numbers. That's what makes the difference. Is that. You would naturally assume that this f prime is more or less of the same order of magnitude as f in the parity violating sector, in the ff tilde coupling. It turns out that actually this term, if f is like a tenth of a Planck mass, that is what I'm thinking of, this term is always very, very small here. So in this contribution, it turns out that it's never important. Basically, because what I care about is regimes where I have a k that is of the order of a Hubble parameter here. So I have one extra h here. So in other words, for this term to become important, this f prime should be something like 10 to 11 GeV. Okay? But if I assume that f prime is a tenth of a Planck mass, then this term is totally negligible during inflation.
But it grows, does it? Or is it
stays constant. I hope I addressed the concern. Okay. Any other question before I go to part two? Okay, second part of the talk. So this is work with Jessica Cook. Gravitational waves for LIGO. Okay, well, motivation, first of all. There are some papers that study that, of course, there are some projects of experiments that are hoping to directly see the tensor modes from inflation, but they are many years from now. Okay, we are talking about BBO, we are talking about the Siegel. The earliest number I saw, the earliest year I saw for this stuff is 2027. Okay, that is still optimistic. However, we have gravitational wave detectors that are online now, or well, they were online and they are going to get online again soon. In particular, I'm thinking about LIGO. So LIGO will become advanced LIGO, well, they say between 2014 and 2015. But in any case, let's say within a handful of years, they will be up and working in an efficient way. Of course, usually the assumption is that LIGO is not sensitive enough to see gravitational waves produced by inflation, okay? And I will discuss this in a second. Now, the observation we made is actually pretty simple, and this is about your question. Let's look again at the result I've shown before, okay? And by the way, now forget about curvatons. Suppose that there are no curvatons. I have just this coupling to FF tilde. And there is an exponential dependence, as I said before, on this parameter psi. But what's psi? Psi is phi dot over fh, okay? Now, during inflation, phi dot increases and h decreases. So during inflation, this parameter psi gets larger and larger. So if I now study the spectral dependence on this, there will be some dependence intrinsic in the time dependence of psi. In particular, later during inflation, psi will be larger, and so the amplitude of these tensor modes will get larger. How larger? Well, exponentially larger, okay? So, as I said, psi increases during inflation, gravitational waves produced towards the end of inflation, that is at smaller scales. There are about 40 folds of inflation between COBE and LIGO scales. We'll have larger amplitude, and this might be detected by advanced LIGO. And as I said, I don't care about FNL anymore because LIGO probes a scale of the order of 3,000 kilometers, and we don't measure FNL at 3,000 kilometers, luckily or unluckily. Okay, so this is another plot stolen again from Kamienkowski, but different collaborators. And it's quite a busy slide, but I will try to give what's the main message, okay? On the horizontal axis, we have frequency of the gravitational waves. On the y-axis, we have amplitude of gravitational waves produced during inflation, okay? Standard models of inflation give a spectrum that is either flat or slightly red. And so best case scenario, it's exactly flat. And we have constraints from WMAP that tell us that at cosmological scales, gravitational waves cannot be larger than, what is that, 10 to minus 14 in these units, OK? So best case scenario, I have to sit in this line if I assume that the spectrum of gravitational waves is flat. And here there is a number of experiments, et cetera. What I will care about is LIGO. This is where advanced LIGO will get. And as you can see, is many orders of magnitude above the gravitational waves produced by inflation, even best case scenario. Well, this is where LISA used to be. BBO and the SIGO, they are planned to go down here, OK? But I don't want to care about this stuff. I want to see something between now and the end of the decade, OK? So if I now plot the spectrum of gravitational waves produced by these photons, I get something like this. Of course, now this becomes model dependent, because this depends on how Xi evolves with inflation. So I've chosen just, you know, vanilla model, phi square. And things don't change significantly if I change the shape of the potential, unless I start doing crazy things. And I have two regimes. So in this regime, it's still just a standard mechanism of gravitational wave production that dominates. And actually, I get a spectrum that is slightly red. And at this point, however, the stuff produced by the photons take over. And it goes up and up and up. And of course, I chose parameters in such a way that I can cross exactly the region where LIGO would be able to detect these things. And again, if I talk to my LIGO friends, they will tell me 2016.
But if that curve is correct, why do people have to see it with the bar detector? So when it goes up by a lot.
Oh. Because this part of the curve, it shouldn't actually be trusted. This is the part of the curve that corresponds to the regime where the back reaction of the photons on the inflating background is too large. So actually, when the curve gets up here, we didn't do the analysis. We expected to stop. Then actually, 2 weeks after our paper came out, there was a paper that I will mention later by, again, Barnaby, Peloso, and Enrico Payer that were studying also the effect of back reaction. And they actually find that this thing flattens out a little bit. Actually, the main constraint is not from direct detection by bar detectors. There's an even stronger constraint that is from BBN. The stronger constraint on primordial gravitational waves come from the fact that they contribute energy to the universe during Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And we know that extra neutrino species, and these gravitational waves would work at an extra neutrino species, so they're not allowed. So turns out that actually, if you do a just back of the envelope calculation, you find that you don't trust this regime. Then you can do a slightly more refined analysis. That is what we did here. And this is, again, for n squared phi squared. This is parameter space now. On the x-axis, I have the total number of refoldings of inflation. That is somehow model dependent, because it depends on rating. On the y-axis, I have this parameter xi computed at COBE scales. Okay, then Xi is a function of time. So this is the value of Xi when COBE scales left the horizon. So from Barnaby et al., I know that this must be smaller than 2.6. And as you can see, well, there is a region here that is the region where I just don't know what to say, because the back reaction of the photons on the background is not analyzed. Now I know what to say because of this other paper that just came out. This is the limit of advanced LIGO. So this whole region, actually, would lead to detection by advanced LIGO. It's not a huge region, OK? Because, again, this parameter xi changes by a factor of less than 2, and I need to be in some special corner of parameter space. But it's a non-zero measure region in parameter space. And I think it's interesting, OK? Also, you know, if you want to go to Einstein telescope, of course, things get better. So there are a few comments about this stuff. This tensor mode should be chiral. And there is some paper that claims that it would be possible to set up three ground-based interferometers to measure the chirality of this primordial stochastic modes. One thing we are working now on is that the statistics of these gravitational waves should be fully non-Gaussian. So h cubed should go as h squared to the 3 over 2, basically. One cute idea, one cute thing would be correlation between this signal and non-Gaussianity studied by Barnaby and Peloso. Suppose the Xi at Cobbe scales is like 2. Then 5 years from now, we see these gravitational waves, as I described before, but also the improvement on non-Gaussianities will also see non-Gaussianities through the improvement on the constraint of Xi from this Barnaby-Peloso mechanism. So in principle, we could see gravitational waves at 3,000 kilometers and non-Gaussianities at 6,000 megaparsecs, and correlate and study the couplings of the inflaton in two very different regimes. You know, one towards the beginning and one towards the end of inflation, calling beginning of inflation the beginning of observable inflation. Okay. And as I said, there is this paper. They performed a more accurate analysis of the mechanism I've just studied, among other things. It's a long paper. But the qualitative behavior I described is confirmed. They have corrections of the order of 20%, but basically everything is confirmed. Is there any other possibility? So since we are in this game, can we use other mechanisms of particle production to produce large gravitational waves? One other possibility would be, instead of steadily producing these photons, can we have some moment of explosive production of particles at some point during inflation? And these particles are, you know, carry some non-vanishing anisotropic stress that produces gravitational waves. So first of all, how can we have some explosive particle production during inflation? Well, this has been studied for more than a decade now. Oh, sorry. So this is the picture I have in mind now, some bump in the spectrum of primordial gravitational waves produced by some bump in particles during inflation. So yes. So this coupling has been studied now for more than 10 years. Suppose so that the inflaton interacts with some another scalar field, chi, with this form of coupling. Okay? And what happens is that as phi rolls down its potential, this is a mass term for chi, and this mass term is large. But then when phi crosses phi naught, the mass goes through 0. As the mass goes through 0, it becomes energetically cheap to produce quanta of chi. And there is energy around because there is the Rolle inflaton. So I end up producing a lot of quantum chi, and it's possible to estimate the number of quanta of chi per unit volume that I produce that goes as g phi dot to the 3 over 2. Okay? So I can produce a lot of these guys. And then these guys will produce gravitational waves. How many of them? Not many. Turns out that the height of the feature in this gravitational wave spectrum is given by the height of the standard gravitational spectrum times 1, the standard part, plus this correction that is associated to the particle production, and this phi dot computed at the moment of particle production. And when you put number in, this goes as 10 to minus 3, a number smaller than 1 times a number smaller than 1 times a number much smaller than 1. So this is way smaller than 1. So this effect is negligible. One could play, as I did before, with the number of chi fields, but you really should put, you know, a ridiculous amount, a ridiculous number of chi species to boost this thing up, because this whole thing gives like a 10 to minus 10 parameter. Okay, so there was a paper that came out short after ours where they were studying sort of the same mechanism, and you know, they have also some ways out that they devised, but let's say in the zeroth order approximation, this is what you get. And the reason why this is happening, actually, there was a paper by Lev and collaborators in 2007. They had a theorem there that is just, you know, scalar waves in Minkowski space don't produce gravitational waves in this regime. And the reason is that they have no spin. Okay. So, well, from this one has an obvious other way out. That is, why don't we use something that has spin? So if instead of producing explosively scalars, what happens if we produce explosively vectors? So, okay, that's the idea. And indeed, we get something. The exponent here before was a 3 over 2, now becomes a 7 over 2. And this is g phi dot over h square. This goes as Planck mass over h, okay? So we have a boost of Planck mass over h squared here. Turns out that, again, it's unfortunate, but this is why when you do calculations, it actually matters to keep pi's and twos into account. And you know, putting just squiggly, wiggly signs can give you the wrong result. There is a 10 to minus 5 in front of here, OK? When you take the 10 to minus 5 into account, it turns out that even if this is a large boost, the whole thing is at most of order 1. But at this point, I am less ashamed of saying that I have many vector species, OK? Because I can just multiply here, and I can even try to give a motivation for this. The original motivation actually for all this particle, well, original. A later motivation for this particle production during inflation was related to these models of brain inflation. And in particular, what you can have is a stack of many, many brains, and then the inflaton is another brain, and is crossing the stack of brains. As it crosses, the most that corresponds to strings stretching from the many brains to the inflaton brain will become light. And if you do it, you have to take into account that there are also gauge fields on these brains. And in particular, what you get is an enhanced gauge symmetry that goes from un cross u1 to un plus 1. And so you have two extra n degrees of freedom that become light when this thing happens. So you can have you can easily motivate this. And for instance, if you just say that you have like 100 gauge bosons, just to fix ideas, you get a peak. This is, again, the power spectrum in the absence of particle production. And then you can get a peak that improves this by a factor of 100, more or less. Okay, so basically, you get an order n boost in the amplitude of primordial of the gravitational waves. Still, unless you want to use a really large number of n, this boost is significant. But if you want to go all the way, let's say, to LISA, that is the next thing, the closest thing to this floor, you still need a boost of a factor of 10 to 4. That is still quite a bit of a stretch. But I hope that at least, you know, qualitatively this matters. And also one, and this is work in progress, one can ask the question, of course, of what happens if this stuff happens when Cobbe's K has left the horizon, OK? And this is still work in progress. Yes. Of its number of e-foldings, roughly speaking.
So it's a very, okay.
It's controlled by the height. It's the shape is basically the same one. It's
physics, so the idea is you're going through this special point.
Yes.
So it's at how long is the field mass this? How long is the gauge field mass this?
No, it's how long it takes for the quantum of gauge fields to get diluted out. The most of the production happens not at the moment you produce the vectors, but then what you have is that these vectors stay around for any folding.
Okay. So then you just say if you have more energy, it just
exactly out. Exactly.
Wait, there are 100 of vectors now to act coherently so that they don't produce a power spectrum large enough to detect. But beforehand, there were 100 of vectors that will act incoherently so that the non-Gaussian wouldn't root them up.
Okay, yes. So what happens is, before I was caring about R.
Okay.
This is not R. This is the amplitude of tensors here. For R, I have to work out. This is why I'm not talking about still Cobbe scales, because I don't want to care about the scalar fluctuations, because that's still work in progress. Okay. But what happens if you have n vectors, then the amplitude of the tensors goes up with n, the amplitude of the scalars goes up with n. So r in first approximation stays constant. But the amplitude of the three-point function also goes up with n. Okay? But f and l is proportional to the amplitude of the three-point function divided by the square of the amplitude of the two-point function. So the f and l goes down as 1 over n. Okay? So this way, you reduce the three-point function while r stays constant. And r stays constant because both the scalar and the tensor spectrum go up. Here, I don't care about the scalar modes because I'm looking at very small scales. Did I address that? Okay. So I'm actually getting close to the end, and that's strangely good on time. So before concluding, I wanted just to insist on one last thing. I've shown you this plot. Okay. One thing that is remarkable is that both in this region and this region, the regions of the tensor spectrum is blue. And usually you hear that, you know, blue tensors are not created unless you violate energy conditions. Here I'm not violating any energy condition. I'm taking very, very mild vanilla assumption, and still I have some region of blue spectrum. Okay? And then, well, these are the conclusions, and I don't even bother reading them. But the main thing is that using this particle production during inflation, you can do a lot of things to the tensors that you would expect that to be very unnatural. You can get parity-violating tensors. You can get large three-point functions. I didn't mention that this is other work in progress, computing a three-point function of the tensors. You can get gravitational waves that we might see before we are all retired, even. And, well, thank you.
So what about moving that blue part to the COBE window?
Well, that's the problem. The problem is that in COBE, you see also the scalar perturbations. Mm-hmm. And the non-Gaussianities. And this is why it's work in progress, because you know the coupling to vectors is, well, it's something we still didn't work out. But before we write a paper on moving the blue part to COBE, I would like to understand what happens to the scalars. And let's say I've been sufficiently traumatized by the non-Gaussianities, by Barnaby and Peloso, to be willing to write something on COBE scales before I double check of not being ruled out by non-Gaussianities. But that's the next thing to do. I mean, that's what we're actually doing now. And it would be very interesting.
Can the photon production be used for slowing down the inflaton, even for a steep potential, or the non-Gaussian to be too large?
Okay, thank you. I can give a new talk now. Yes, we had a paper with Mohamed who's here, where we were studying exactly this. We were saying, as there was a question before in the audience, you know, when these gravitational waves get huge, what happens? And I said, what happens is that the back reaction of the photons on the background of the inflating background becomes non-negligible. Now, we studied the regime where actually the back reaction of the photon becomes so important that you basically can generate slow roll because, not because of the flatness of the potential, but because of these dissipative effects. Okay? So, in other words, what's happening is that the inflaton satisfies this equation of motion, okay? But this guy, as I said, goes as e to the phi dot. So if this guy becomes bigger than this guy and this guy, I can get a solution where phi dot, well, this is phi dot divided by fh, where phi dot goes as fh log of this junk and, you know, the coefficients here. And so if fh is sufficiently small, then you can have slow roll during inflation. We computed the scalar perturbations there. Turns out that the spectrum of scalar perturbations is too large. It's naturally of the order of, you know, instead of being 10 to minus 9, it's naturally of the order of 10 to minus 4. Again, we had to use tricks because we wanted to write the paper because I think the idea was very nice, and I didn't feel bad in trying to use ways out of this. And again, the trick is, if you have many species of this guy, again, incoherent sum, the spectrum of scalar perturbations goes down, and it becomes, but you need 10 to 5 species. So still, I think it's, you know, it's a nice existence proof of getting inflation on a steep potential.
On these very small scales where the gravity wave power spectrum is running off, what's the scalar power spectrum doing? Is it also running amplitudes?
Yeah,
so
again, we did a computation about this.
From like primordial black holes on the amplitude of small scale density fluctuations?
I will refer you to the paper by Peloso, Barnaby, and Pyre. They talk about this stuff. Basically, it's all things that can be very easily evaded. Yes.
So how can they include the back reaction of photons on, this calculation?
on the slow roll. So, well, you use this expression basically. When the back reaction of photons becomes important, then the, you approximate this in hard approximation.
Is that the same thing that they did as well? I mean,
yes, they are just using this formula.
You did the same thing.
So, and what they find is that effectively, this is actually nice, effectively, inflation ends later, because now this mechanism is driving inflation. So you have few more effects of inflation. There actually, that's their main physics result in this aspect, is that you have a few more effects of inflation, so everything gets shifted. But at the same time, you know, you have now the amplitude of the tensors that, you know, I was plotting something that goes like this, now we find that it goes like this. That is what makes sense.
Reaction because important
independent
of the model, or you said the
final. It depends on the value of f. Okay, uh-huh. If you are willing to take an f sufficiently small, you can have this back reaction important for all of the history of inflation. This is what we did with Mohammed, but then the scalar fluctuations get too large unless you use, you know, many photons.
Okay, so
but this is again why we don't care too much about it, because we are looking at, you know, 1,000 kilometers scales.
My intuition then correct that the usual dilation effect that I would expect if I added just photon back, it would completely dilute, is now nothing. This F controls like how much you put in.
Okay, so
not too much, not too low.
Exactly. So the point is, you know, you start producing this stuff, and initially you produce more than they are diluted, and eventually you get some stationary regime where you produce as many as they are diluted. So if I didn't plot it here, but if you plot the spectrum of the photons during inflation, it's independent of time. And it's peaked inside the horizon. And the peak is at this h scale times the parameter psi. And the parameter psi must be larger than 1 in momentum space.
No other questions? Let's thank Lawrence again.
Thank you.